Hello and welcome in.
First Science. Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. Degenerative diseases still plague our society and are the subject of intensive research that has been giving a recent boost with the advent of gene therapies and their closely related techniques. Ed Wild, our guest today, is a researcher and the primary investigator at UCL's Huntington Disease Centre, where he's been looking into new methods to both detect and treat this terrible disease. Welcome, Ed.
Hi, great to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you on. So we are going to start off the show, as we normally do, with a riddle. Iman, what do we have this week?
Right, so our riddle for this week is, if I drilled a hole from one end of the earth to the other and then jumped through it, how long would I take to travel through?
Okay, so this is the hole right through the center of the earth.
Yeah.
And you jump through it, how long does it take?
Yeah.
And so people can get in touch on Twitter if they want to try and figure out how this is. And I think we're going to do this as a...
as a closest guest.
Closest guest.
I'll be very impressed if you go
whoever
into
gets
the
closest. All right, brilliant. Okay, Ed, let's go in straight into your first song. And you've chosen Mammal by They Might Be Giants. Why have you chosen this?
Yeah, so this is a really kind of unashamedly geeky song. I started listening to They Might Be Giants when I first went to university to study medicine. And this is a song about mammals, and it contains lots of facts about mammals, from very basic things, like some of them have hair, to some interesting facts about the taxonomy of mammals and the fact that they're related to other species, like the duck-billed platypus. It's just a very informative song that has a very catchy tune.
That's great.
Science.
On Science Mixtape, exactly.
Glass of milk, standing in between extinction in the cold and explosive radiating growth. So the warm blood flows through the large four-chambered heart, maintaining the very high metabolism rate there.
Huntington's disease was described as early as 1841 by Charles Oscar Waters.
Yeah, Huntington's disease, that's what we're talking about today. And Ed, let's start at the top. What is Huntington's disease?
Okay, so the bottom line is it's super depressing. But don't worry, I'm going to be upbeat about it. And we're heading towards good news, I think. So Huntington's is a neurodegenerative disease, which means it's a condition in which brain cells die more quickly than they should. Bottom line, everyone's brain cells, if you're over the age of 25, your brain cells are dying all the time. You'll end up, at the end of this Science Mixtape, you'll have millions fewer brain cells than you had at the start. However much we try to keep people's brain cells alive.
I think that's what critics would say anyway, that they lost a few brain cells.
Especially when I'm talking.
I think we make some new connections here.
Right, exactly. It's the connections, not the numbers, that really matters. In neurodegenerative diseases, the brain cells die more quickly, and that happens for a variety of reasons. Huntington's is a reasonably rare neurodegenerative disease that's distinguished by the fact that it runs in families. So it's from the very first time it was described, it was known to be genetic. There was a very strong tendency for it to be inherited in families. In 1993, we discovered the cause of that. It was the single genetic mutation on a gene loosely called Huntingtin. And so what happens is, essentially, as the mutation and the protein that the gene is a recipe for damages brain cells, gradually they die. And what that produces is a combination of problems with movement. So people with HD tend to lose control of their voluntary movements.
You said before that it had this other name that it used to have, which was chorea, right?
Right. So originally it was called Huntington's chorea. And chorea is from a Greek word that means a dance, and we get the word choreography from the same root.
Same root, okay.
So people would see patients with Huntington's, and the most obvious thing about them was that they were very fidgety, and their limbs and face and body were kind of jerking around. So they called it Huntington's chorea.
Right.
It's not quite clear when the name changed, but from about the 1970s onwards, we've been trying to get people to call it Huntington's disease, because actually the involuntary movements are obvious, but they're not the thing that causes the most disability, the most problems,
okay,
which is the other stuff. Things like loss of thinking ability, change in personality, mm-hmm, psychiatric problems like depression, anxiety, mm-hmm, apathy. Those are the things that really cause Huntington's to, you know, ruin people's lives. And it really is a really terrible disease.
Is that the kind of psychiatric problems? Are they as a result of damage to the brain cells, or are they as a result of having a disease that is...
That's a really good question, and I think it's both. You know, people living with Huntington's disease, even if they haven't got symptoms yet, tend to have lives that are more challenging, mm-hmm, because in most cases, you know, even if you're growing up at risk, you'll have a parent who has the disease, or a grandparent, aunts, right, and uncles, brothers, sisters. So the life of someone from an HD family is much more difficult in most, mm-hmm, cases. On top of that, HD changes the circuitry in the brain that and makes it more prone to anxiety and depression. So it's kind of a, right, double
whammy. This is one of these kind of slow progressive diseases. So it takes many years for this to develop. What's the kind of development like of Huntington's disease over however long it takes?
So it usually comes on in what we call mid-adult life. So patients are in their 30s, 40s, 50s. The symptoms come on very, very slowly. So, mm-hmm, most people, by the time a neurologist officially diagnoses someone with HD, yep, most people have had vague or mild or slowly developing symptoms of depression, anxiety, yep, and subtle problems with movement for 10 or 15 years.
It's quite difficult to tell. I think you just put it down to age.
Right, that's the thing. And, you know, a lot of people get more grumpy in their 30s. You know, I can speak from personal experience here. And depression is very common. Anxiety, mm-hmm, is very common in the general population. And so distinguishing those from the first signs of Huntington's, yeah, can be very difficult. So, but once the official diagnosis is made, which is on the basis of the movement problem, mm-hmm, as well as everything, mm-hmm, else, it's about 20 to 25 years duration until Huntington's causes death. But unfortunately, from very early on in the disease, mm, people are disabled. You know, most people, after symptoms begin, have to leave work within a couple of years.
Okay.
Within 5 years or so, they need to use a wheelchair.
Okay.
And it just progresses inexorably, unfortunately.
So it is ultimately a fatal disease, and people do die due to Huntington's.
Yeah. I mean, the cause of death on the death certificates is often things like pneumonia or heart, mm, failure. But it's the Huntington's, you know, yeah, essentially stripping people of their ability to, mm-hmm, use their body and think... you know, that's what causes people to die.
How is Huntington's kind of different or unique compared to other kinds of degenerative neurological diseases?
I mean, the main thing is that every single case of Huntington's is due to the same basic genetic mutation.
Right.
And that's not the case with the common genetic, neurodegenerative illnesses like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's,
okay,
in which less than 1% of people have an identifiable mutation. So, sometimes Huntington's is viewed as a kind of a test chamber because we know the cause of every case of HD. So that gives us a real kind of tangible target that we, mm, can aim at. We can study the disease, we can develop model systems in which to figure out what's happening, and then we can produce treatments that are focusing on the known cause of the disease.
And this is a relatively recent advancement. This was only 30 years ago or something that actually this
93, so it's 24 years that the gene was discovered. It was one of the first to be discovered in any brain disease. And it was a huge effort. In fact, the technologies that enabled this gene to be discovered then went on to form the basis of the Human Genome Project.
Oh, amazing.
Like complete Brave New World territory. Mm. It was a remarkable achievement. And since then, it's now routine to discover genes. But it was Huntington's and other disease like cystic fibrosis were the first, you know, few illnesses where you really had to kind of comb through the genome one letter at a time. And it was the surprising thing was that we discovered, I say we, it was other people. I was at school. that they discovered the gene as early as they did.
Yeah. I think it also makes it slightly easier in the fact that, as you said, it was a single mutation. I mean, that makes it easier to pinpoint than other things that we have, like multiple genes known for, or genes plus environment.
Right, absolutely. And the clues were there because it runs so strongly in families. But with something like Alzheimer's, when the first Alzheimer's gene was discovered, there was a load of excitement. And then it was slightly tempered by the fact that it was only, you know, one person in 200 that actually had this mutation.
Right.
So it was a clue, but it clearly wasn't the answer in everyone.
Okay.
With Huntington's, overnight, everything changed. Suddenly, we knew what the problem was that we had to fix.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, give a scientist a tangible problem like that, and they can really go to town.
A well-defined problem. And you're actually working on this now, so we're going to talk a little bit more later about the efforts that you're making to try and, you know, cure this disease, essentially. That's the goal. We're going to move on to your second song, which is Philip Glass. You've chosen Einstein on the Beach. This is an interesting one. Why did you pick this?
So this is a slight reflection of my complex relationship with music, which is that from time to time I get completely obsessed by a song, and then I wake up one morning and I'm not that interested in it anymore. But broadly speaking, I like to listen to music when I work, but it's kind of in the background. So Philip Glass for me is the ideal composer because his music is just kind of very sort of repetitive. You always know more or less what's coming next. But this is a slightly special one because it has words, but the words are numbers, so it's not too distracting.
Let's have a little listen. This is Philip Glass with Einstein on the Beach.
Huntington's disease is one of over a dozen trinucleotide repeat disorders, where strings of three DNA pairs are repeated over and over again.
Yeah, Ed, you were just comparing the counting in the song to this kind of counting within the DNA of Huntington's disease, and it comes from this three base pairs that just repeat over and over again.
Right, exactly. That was not by design, but I guess sheer good fortune. So we have these letters in our DNA, and we represent them as letters, but they're actually sort of chemical ingredients, and you string them all together, and that's what makes DNA. And in converting the DNA into a protein, because DNA is recipes for proteins, each three letters in our DNA corresponds to one building block in the protein, mm-hmm. and those are called amino acids. So in Huntington's disease, the remarkable thing that was discovered in 1993 is that the beginning of this Huntington gene has lots of CAGs in a row. Mm-hmm. And in humans, there's about somewhere between 10 and 20 in a sort of normal, healthy copy of the gene. But in someone who has Huntington's disease or someone who is going to develop HD later on, there are 40 or more, and in some cases, lots more. And each of those CAGs corresponds to one glutamine building block mm-hmm. in the Huntington protein. And it seems like over evolutionary time, evolution has been pushing for there to be more and more of these CAGs. Okay. And that seems to be a good thing. So sea urchins have one CAG, right. and flies have maybe five, mice have seven or eight, chimpanzees mm-hmm. have 10 to 12, and then humans have up to 20.
Okay.
When you reach 35, yeah. something bad happens, and there's too many, so there's too much of a good thing. And that's when the protein starts to be harmful. And 40 or more mm-hmm. is when everyone gets HD. So there's something weird that happens to this protein. Okay. It still does useful stuff, but it also has this sort of dark side. It becomes toxic to neurons.
And it's the production of this protein. Is this the basis of how you can develop tests to see if you can actually have Huntington's disease? Is it the presence of this protein you test for, or how can you see whether someone has it, or do you actually have to sequence their DNA to see if they have it?
Yeah, so we test the DNA, mm-hmm. And if you are someone who knows that they are at risk of Huntington's, so if you have a parent with the disease, then each of their children is at 50% risk, mm-hmm. because mum or dad will have one healthy copy of the gene and one expanded copy of the gene, and there's a 50-50 chance that they'll pass down each copy. Yeah. So it's like tossing a coin. Heads, you're fine. Tails, you're going to get Huntington's at some point. And testing the DNA is relatively straightforward. It's done routinely for lots of conditions, but Huntington's was one of the first ones for which it could be done. We can measure the level of the protein now as well. So since about 2015, we've been able to detect the actual concentration of the mutant protein in the spinal fluid which surrounds the nervous system.
Okay.
And that was an important breakthrough. Because until then, it was actually very difficult. We knew that people were producing this mutant protein, mm-hmm. but we didn't know what the relationship was between how much protein there was and where they were in the disease course. But that's not something we do clinically. Clinically, what we can offer is a genetic test that it gives people a degree of certainty. You will definitely get the disease.
Okay.
But there's also a lot of uncertainty. And we can't predict when it will happen or what precise form it will take. And so it's a complicated problem for everyone from an HD family.
I think it's an interesting question. You can take this test, which can essentially determine that your most likely cause of death. And do you want to know that you have it? I think that's a morally tricky question. Would you take the test knowing that there's a chance that you're just going to get it?
And you've got the rise of companies like 23andMe who kind of offer this service to a very wide population. But again, it's kind of saying, do I want to know that I'm more at risk of... It might change, you know, the way I decide to lead my life, whether I have children or not. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you're just starting to think about what you would do and you're not sure, I think that's exactly the right place to be. Okay, so if you're from an HD family, there's no right or wrong answers about testing.
Absolutely.
And everyone goes through a process of genetic counselling to sort of play out the various scenarios, if it's positive, if it's negative, how would this affect that? What about kids? What about mortgage? What about insurance? For the first 5 years while I was in the field, I didn't know what I would do if I found out that I was at risk for Huntington's disease. I think now I would test.
Okay.
But that's informed in my case by knowing a lot about where the research is and what science can already offer for families with Huntington's disease. But it's a really difficult, would you want to know that at some point in the future you're going to get terribly sick and die, but we can't tell you when? And there's no
treatment. I think maybe the knowing when is quite important. How is it going in terms of looking into that and being able to determine whether or not someone will have this disease at age 35 or age 45? Can you do those tests? Are people working on trying to pin it down a bit better?
Yeah, so after a while, it became apparent that the number of CAGs in your gene is a strong predictor of how old you will be when you get the illness.
There's a type of ataxia. I know this is completely unrelated. That's like a polyglutamine expansion as well. Are they related in disease mechanism?
Well, they are, but we don't quite understand why. So there's a group of conditions called the spinocerebellar ataxias, and several of them have the same CAG expansion at the beginning of their gene. Mm-hmm. And so there's obviously something special about having too many glutamines in brain-related proteins.
And they're related to, like, how many you have is more, how likely you're going to get. If you have more, you might be more likely to get it on.
Yeah, that's quite interesting.
But...
No, go on then.
But it doesn't predict with accuracy. So only about 70% of the age of onset comes from the CAG. The rest comes from other genes and environmental factors, which is a big focus of study.
What are the environmental factors?
We don't know. But we're trying to figure it out.
Okay.
Live healthy is our best advice.
Look into that. We're going to move on to your third song, Ed. You've got The Divine Comedy with National Express. Yeah? Why did you choose this song?
So, I mean, it's a really kind of upbeat, cheerful song, and it's quite funny, and I enjoy funny things. But this was on our the music that we played before we came on stage during the 1998, I think, Cambridge Medics Review. This was a very joyful time in my life, a time of
great
fun and silliness. And this song takes me back to that.
American folk musician Woody Guthrie died from complications due to Huntington's disease, despite being diagnosed with alcoholism for years previously.
So, unfortunately, we lost Woody Guthrie to Huntington's, but all is not lost. You are looking into new investigations into gene therapies that are actually trying to help people who suffer from this disease. What's happening at the moment?
So, like I said, this knowing the cause of every case of HD gives us a solid target. And the good thing about genes and the way proteins are made from genes is that it's all very well worked out. It's called the basic dogma of biology. Good to have a dogma if you're going to try and solve a problem. So, and DNA is sticky. It sticks to itself and related molecules in very predictable ways. Mm. And in between the DNA and the protein, there are these message molecules that are made from a sort of cousin of DNA called mRNA. And in the distant future, we may be doing genome editing, so snipping out people's genes and trying to shrink that CAG expansion.
So actually affecting the DNA itself.
Yeah.
That's cool.
That's something that's being aimed at, but that's super tricky because if you get it wrong, you can cause mutations in the wrong places.
Absolutely.
It's difficult to deliver. So that's
it's permanent,
stuff is,
I guess.
Right, and it's permanent. There's no off switch for that kind of thing. So that's in its infancy. What we are already attempting for the first time now is trying to sort of interact not with the DNA, but with this messenger molecule. Mm. That stuff floats around freely in cells, and it's quite easy to design drugs. I say it's easy. It's taken 24 years. Drugs that will actually, they're designer drugs, and they essentially stick to the message molecule of any chosen target gene, but no other, using that special stickiness of DNA, the way that DNA bases bind in pairs.
And then do affect the protein that is going to be made.
Right. So what happens is So the drug that we're testing is called an antisense oligonucleotide, or ASO, which is a single strand of chemically modified DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And it's designed to stick to the mRNA from the Huntington gene, but no other gene.
Okay.
And when it does that, the cell has a machinery for detecting double strands, so DNA plus DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Those aren't supposed to be floating around in the nucleus. So the cell has this whole machinery built into it that says, hang on, this shouldn't be there.
Mm-hmm.
Let me get rid of this. I'm going to chew it up and recycle it. And
okay.
And
right.
Then that. And once the mRNA is gone, the protein isn't made anymore. So these are sometimes called gene silencing therapies. In our case, we call it a Huntington lowering therapy.
So the DNA still has the encoding for creating this RNA, which then creates the protein, but you're actually turning off the gene in effect by stopping it.
Right, exactly.
Being expressed.
You're turning off the tap. The tap is still there, but you're turning it off. And it should work. I mean, we know that this gene and its protein are the cause of every case of Huntington's disease.
So what stage are we at now in terms of doing this research?
So it was first tested in a mouse model of Huntington's disease in about 2005, and we didn't know what would happen. Like, it could be, it's possible that in some way the DNA is toxic, or that, you know, the enough of the protein would still be around to cause damage. But the mice got better. So after they were treated after they developed symptoms.
So as in a reversal?
Exactly. The symptoms improved.
Oh, my God.
And the pathology, the damage in the brain also improved, which tells us that the brain is really good at looking after itself if you can just lighten the burden a little bit. So that's what we're trying to do. And in September 2015, we started the first human trial of a drug of this kind.
Okay.
All right.
Huntington's Disease Centre of University College London are the lead clinical site. My friend and mentor, Sarah Tabrizi, is the principal investigator, and we are testing a drug made by Ionis Pharmaceuticals, who used to be called Isis, but they changed their name and nobody knows
obvious
why.
Reasons.
And we inject it into the spinal fluid, so it's it's not a normal, you know, take a box of pills home and take one a day. People come into the treatment center and receive injections of an experimental drug into their spinal fluid.
Why
once
in
a
the
month.
Spine?
Well, so the brain is very good at protecting itself. Humans are, well, animals are very kind of experimental creatures. We'll eat stuff, we'll expose ourselves to all kind of harm in our environment. And the brain has evolved in a way that basically protects us.
Yep.
Whatever damage we do to our body, we have this blood-brain barrier that protects us
from
any kind of harmful chemicals. Mm. So it's really difficult to design a drug that gets into the brain. And this particular drug, because it's made of DNA, if you took it as a pill, it would just dissolve in the stomach. If you injected it into the blood, it would stay in the blood and be removed by the liver and kidneys, never reach the brain. So we kind of have this secret back door. You can stick a needle into someone's spine. Sorry if you're having breakfast. And you access this fluid called cerebrospinal fluid. It's produced by the brain, and it surrounds the brain and spinal cord. And if you inject a drug into there and wait a few hours, the drug will diffuse up the spinal cord, up spinal column, into the brain. And if it's the right kind of design of drug, it will sink into the brain, get into cells, and switch off the gene.
Amazing.
That's what we hope.
Amazing.
So there are people now walking around currently with this drug in their system, and we're still in testing stages and seeing if it actually makes a massive difference. It's quite exciting time for therapy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a real kind of paradigm shift. And to me, it must be what it felt like in 93 when overnight everything changed and suddenly we knew the cause. When I've been in this field for 12 years now and I never thought we'd get to this stage. Yeah. Well, I always hoped that we would I intended to get there. But when it happened and now it's working seemingly well, I wake up every morning and my first thought is there are people in the world with this drug in their nervous system. Yeah. We don't know whether it works yet, by the way. We know so far that it looks safe.
Well,
right. Mm. Right. It's our best hope yet. And there are people in the world who have this drug in their nervous system now.
That's incredibly amazing. Promising. Let's move on to your next song, which actually is Anchors Away by Miners, and it has a special significance to Huntington's. What was that significance?
Right, yeah. So this was a kind of a bit of a whirlwind of stuff that's happened over the past couple of years. There's this family from LA, and one of the members of the family is called Kate Miner, who's an actor, and she's in a folk band with her husband, Justin, and the band is called Miner, M-I-N-E-R. And about 2.5 years ago, Kate found out that her mum, Debbie, has Huntington's disease, okay. And that had not been known about in their family at all before. And whenever this happens, it's like an atom bomb going off. Suddenly, you know, you've got a sick relative, you find out they've got a terrible disease, and by the way, everyone else in the family is at 50% risk or something like that. And so it's horrendous. And it's perfectly common and understandable for people to go to pieces. But this family stood their ground, turned around and said, let's deal with this, let's fight. And they are now very powerful advocates, fundraisers. They had a fundraiser in LA last year that raised $300,000 in one night for Huntington's Amazing. Disease research and awareness. And their latest album, which is called Tuanaki, is about Kate going through the process of being counseled and undergoing genetic testing for Huntington's disease.
Right. So, yeah, here's very, very closely related. Here's Anchors Away by Miners.
Little flame in the cabin is flickering. I've been sailing through the night all days. I have played both the saint and the charlatan. Cast off my soul, I couldn't hold that weight.
The worldwide prevalence of Huntington's disease is 12 cases per 100,000 people.
Science
News! Mars' surface could be a lethal cocktail for life.
Scientists discover the structure of the tau protein involved in Alzheimer's disease.
Dinosaur skeleton discovered on the Surrey Brick Factory.
Italian fusion research on shaky ground.
CRISPR genome editing used to treat a Huntington's disease mouse for the first time.
Religious leaders get high on magic mushroom ingredient for science.
For science. It's always
important,
for science.
Important.
It's always for science. For magic science. Mushrooms. Go on then. You're getting high for science. Let's hear about that.
Oh, amazing. So I really, really want to talk about this one. So you've got a Catholic priest, a rabbi and a Buddhist, which sounds like the beginning of a very bad joke, but it is for science. Scientists at Johns Hopkins University were testing psychedelic drugs to see whether or not it would enhance their religious experience. As listeners may know, we had Robin Carhart-Harris on a while ago, who talked about the use of psychedelic drugs and its potential treatment in depression. And that's a similar strand of what the scientists at the university are trying to do here. There's long been a kind of link between potential link between psychotropic drugs such as LSD or MDMA, and we're only really now trying to test it, especially in humans, to see how it could be used for
for different kind of therapies.
For different therapies.
We had Robin on the show a little while back, and that was absolutely fascinating. Yeah, you can go back and listen to the show on iTunes or whatever, or Mixcloud, and listen to the whole thing. So if you can do that, that'd be great.
Very, very cool.
So I, this week, found out that apparently the surface of Mars could not have life at all because it's toxic for the life that's on Mars. So this is a report has been found. They found these chemical compounds called perchlorates, and they have known to be on the surface of Mars, but some researchers at Edinburgh University have shown that if you take these chemicals and you expose them to UV light, as would happen, because Mars has quite a thin atmosphere, so you expose them to this light and actually they develop into other chemicals, which now is a mixture of kind of oxidants and iron oxides in the Martian soil. They're basically like a bactericide, so they make it very, very difficult for life to survive.
Damn.
Bummer. Yeah. So maybe life isn't survive on the very top surface. The thing is that maybe it would be somewhere below. So down in the soil where you don't get the same exposure to UV light, and so you could possibly get life. So all is not lost for life on Mars.
I think we can't underestimate this type of thing. So, you know, like mechanisms, evolution, they'll be fine.
So there are some people who think that maybe actually these perchlorates are the source of energy, and that other life forms could draw their energy from that rather than directly from the sun. So we're still, I don't know.
It's still some hope.
There's still some hope of life on Mars. Ed, you're saying that actually a mouse has been treated with CRISPR. This is this gene therapy that we were talking about earlier, but actually affects the DNA, not just the RNA. What's happened here?
Right. So for the past couple of years, CRISPR is no longer just a thing used for keeping salads fresh. Do you have a double drum cymbal sound effect that you could use?
There you go.
And so CRISPR-Cas9 is this kind of immune system that bacteria have to defend themselves from enemy DNA. And it turns out that you can kind of hijack it and turn it into a set of tools for editing genomes, which is, we're living in the future. Mm-hmm. And so CRISPR-Cas9's been in the news a lot. First, there was a ton of excitement, and then there was a little bit of a backlash. Maybe it could be introducing harmful mutations. Yeah. I think the science is proceeding at an appropriate rate. And what was announced in the past week or so was that a team of scientists has treated a Huntington's disease mouse for the first time with a CRISPR genome editing method. Mm-hmm. So they let the mice get sick, and then they injected the CRISPR weapon, I guess, into their brains, and it's programmed to snip out the bit of the protein that contains that harmful CAG expansion, and the mice got better. So that's cool.
So we're next level for that kind of
right. And structure. So that in these mice with this technique is what happened 12 years ago with these so-called gene silencing or Huntington lowering drugs. And now we're on a journey of how do we make this work in humans?
I was saying to you before that CRISPR is something that it's got a lot of attention and excitement in the science community, but I'm very much looking at the outside and I have no idea how it's being used other than the fact that it's brilliant. But I mean, this is an amazing step forward.
Right. I think, you know, we're all on a journey with CRISPR in the science world. It sounds great and it sounds promising. And of course, people's first reaction is, well, you know, let's use this to cure my illness. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do want to do. But what we also know is that it's a long journey. You have to test it in cells. You have to test it in animals. And then getting, you know, a mouse brain is about the size of the thumbnail. Yeah. Okay. So scaling up from that to treating a human safely, and in a way that doesn't screw up all their other genes, is a huge journey. We're on it. We're taking it as fast as we can while being appropriately careful. Mm. We'll get there.
That's great. I mean, we're going to have to move on, otherwise we're running out of time. This Huntington stuff is so interesting. Ed, we've got your next song, which is Shakira and Try Everything. Yes. Why did you choose Shakira?
So I agree. This is not necessarily a song for serious scientists. But I do a lot of.
I disagree.
Okay, fair enough. Oh, thank you. I feel affirmed by that. I do a lot of outreach to Huntington's families. I spend a lot of time talking to audiences of HD families and telling them what's happening in language that's hopefully understandable. And I saw this. I saw the movie Zootopia, from which this song is taken. And it says, you know, I fall down, I get up again. Try everything. We're going to keep trying, even if we fail, and we're not gonna quit.
Life of an academic.
So for me, this represents the whole HD community. It's a very collaborative community. It's patients, it's families. Mm. They're afflicted with this terrible disease, and yet they keep getting up. We keep making new things for them to try. They keep trying them, and we're not going to quit till the problem is solved.
That's great. So this is Try Everything from Shakira.
The 6th of June has been designated as National Huntington's Disease Awareness Day.
Oh, so in my research I found that, but do we have one in the UK yet?
I think we have an awareness month, which is May, if I'm not mistaken. Okay. And please tweet me if that's wrong and I will retweet.
That's fine. So you've actually been involved in developing HD Buzz, which is a website which can disseminate news and information. How's that going? And people find it useful? How can people find it if they want to look up a bit more about Huntington's?
Yeah, so that's hdbuzz.net or at hdbuzzfeed on Twitter. And this was a website that I set up in, I think it was 2010, with a friend and colleague of mine who's called Jeff Carroll. And Jeff grew up in an HD family, and he was in the US Army when he found out that he was at risk. He dropped out of high school, so he educated himself through the Army, went and got tested, and then said to the guy who gave him his positive HD test result, "Please, can I have a job?" And now Jeff is one of the most prominent American HD researchers.
Oh, my God.
It's a really interesting story. He's on Twitter as well. You can find him through me. And basically, he and I both used to sort of hang out at conferences lamenting how bad the research news was that was available to HD families who didn't have scientific backgrounds. And after discussing with lots of family members, we started HD Buzz to sort of spread plain language research news about HD, free to use and share, free to access, and it's all online. And we take people from, wow, this is cool, to this is why it's cool, and also this is what happens next. So context is important. So like with CRISPR, super cool, but people need to know it's going to be a long time before it's a treatment for HD. So we like to do a bit of context as well.
So it's like it's useful for every day, for people who don't have that scientific background, to get some information and find out what's going on in the world of Huntington's research.
Right, exactly. And our big thing is substantive hope. So it's appropriate for people to hope for a cure for HD, but we want to give them lots of little things to hope for in the meantime.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. Yeah, well, it's great. And you've been doing some great work and spreading the word about it. And it looks like in the future, we're going to start having some cures for this. We're at the end of our show now, unfortunately. And let's have the answer to our puzzle. Iman, let's hear it one more time and then we'll see who gets closer.
So if I drilled a hole, theoretically, of course, from one end of the earth to the other and then jumped through because my life is miserable, how long would it take for me to fall out the other side? I've had no correct answers.
Oh, no.
Which makes me sad.
So I actually know the answer to this one, so I'm kind of cheating.
Isn't the answer you'd have terrible trouble obtaining planning permission?
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's a valid answer. Yeah,
There's the fact that I couldn't drill it on my own. There's the fact that I'd probably die in the middle of the earth.
But what's the answer for people?
But theoretically, for me to get through to the other side would be 42 minutes and 12 seconds, which is quite a long time.
Oh, I had 42 minutes and 11 seconds.
The earth's pretty big, so that could kind of make sense.
Very close, Ed. Actually, this is an interesting problem in that it doesn't matter which two points on the earth you join, as long as you draw the correct shape curve. It always takes, even if the two points are only a mile apart, it will still take 42 minutes and 12 seconds to traverse between those two points. So awesome. Amazing.
Very cool.
For joining us on Science Mixtape. If you'd like to listen again to any of the shows, they can be found on Mixcloud. All of our shows also go up in the usual podcast mediums. Rate us, help others find out about the show, and get in touch on at Science Mixtape on Twitter or Science Mixtape on Instagram or Facebook. Tell us what you like, what you want more of. Thank you to Abhi Sharman and our
Thank
guest today,
much.
Ed Wild. It's his final choice that's going to play us out, and we have Seeing You from Groundhog Day. Why this one?
So I'm not a fan of musicals at all, but there are maybe two or three musicals that I've recently been encouraged to enjoy. And this is from Groundhog Day, written by Tim Minchin. Everyone knows that Tim is a brilliant composer, performer, comedian. And this is a kind of a really uplifting song from the end of a fabulous musical. And it's a really cool song.
Yeah, guys, enjoy. And thank you and goodbye.
Drove out of town, took a right onto a northbound highway. Was it really only yesterday? If I had known what now I know, maybe I would have taken a moment. Maybe looked over my shoulder. Maybe shed a tear. Now I'm here. A storm blew in, overwhelmed me sometime late this morning. Think I ignored the warning. I've spent a lifetime seeking signs, reading lines, trying to forecast the future, always staying a day ahead. Well, that was the idea.